And 2 years ago, democracy faced its greatest threats in civil war. And today, though bruised, our democracy remains unbowed and unbroken. As we gather here tonight, we're writing the next chapter in the great American story, a story of progress and resilience. When world leaders ask me to define America, and they do, believe it or not, I say I can define it in one word, and I mean this: possibilities. We don't think anything is beyond our capacity. Everything is a possibility. You know, we're often told that Democrats and Republicans can't work together. But over the past 2 years, we've proved the cynics and naysayers wrong. Yes, we disagreed plenty. And yes, there were times when Democrats went alone. But time and again, Democrats and Republicans came together to defend a stronger and safer Europe. It came together to pass once in a generation infrastructure law, building bridges connecting our nation and our people. We came together to pass the most significant law ever, helping victims expose the toxic burn pits. And in fact, it's important. And in fact, I signed over 300 bipartisan pieces of legislation since becoming president. From reauthorizing the Violence Against Women Act, the Electoral Count Reform Act, the Respect for Marriage Act that protects the right to marry the person you love. And to my Republican friends, if we could work together the last Congress, there's no reason we can't work together and find consensus on important things in this Congress as well.
That was a small portion of the State of the Union speech that President Joe Biden gave on the evening of February 7th, 2023. By the time many of you listen to this podcast, he will have delivered his 2024 message to Congress, one that is widely expected to lay out his agenda for a second term and provide a compelling argument for the voters to give him a Democratic House and Senate to work with. Biden is commonly criticized not for his abilities, but for his age. And yet his age makes him an important link to the past and tells us a great deal about his embrace of a political agenda forwarded by the Democratic Party's Progressive Caucus. Why has Biden, an establishment Democrat, gotten behind LGBT rights, women's rights, racial justice, and anti-poverty programs? Because he is a liberal. Although today the word liberal is synonymous with moderation and centrism, that isn't its history. For much of the 20th century, it was liberals, in both the Democratic and the Republican parties, who pushed American society closer to equality. Beginning with Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the 1930s, liberals, often culling ideas from socialists, feminists, and populists, were the leading figures of the American progressive movement. We forget that at our peril. And if you watch tonight's State of the Union, you will see how liberals transformed politics. Sitting behind Biden's right shoulder will be Kamala Harris, the first woman, Black, and South Asian person to become Vice President of the United States. In front of Biden will be Nancy Pelosi, the first woman to occupy the Speaker's chair, and Hakeem Jeffries, the first Black American to serve as the leader of either party. And there will be Associate Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, Biden's only Supreme Court appointment and the first Black woman to serve in that role. Joe Biden didn't make today's Democratic Party. He inherited it from Hubert Horatio Humphrey, Jr. On January 3, 1973, when Biden took his first oath as the junior senator from Delaware, Humphrey may even have been in the audience. Watching this fiery 31-year-old liberal, Humphrey might have recalled his own arrival on the Senate floor as a freshly minted 37-year-old senator. A rising star in the Democratic Party, when he took the oath in 1949, Humphrey became the leader of the party's liberal faction when, as the progressive boy mayor of Minneapolis, he fought for and won a civil rights plank in the 1948 Democratic platform.
Friends, delegates, I do not believe that there can be any compromise on the guarantees of the civil rights which we have mentioned in the minority report. In spite of my desire for unanimous agreement on the entire platform, in spite of my desire to see everybody here in honest and unanimous agreement, there are some matters which I think must be stated clearly and without qualification. There can be no hedging. The newspaper headlines are wrong. There will be no hedging, and there will be no watering down, if you please, of the instruments and the principles of the civil rights program. To those who say, my friends, to those who say that we are rushing this issue of civil rights, I say to them, we are 172 years late. To those who say that this civil rights program is an infringement on states' rights, I say this: the time has arrived in America for the Democratic Party to get out of the shadows of states' rights and to walk forthrightly into the bright sunshine of human rights.
You can hear the boos among the cheers. That speech caused numerous segregationist Southern delegates, led by South Carolina Senator Strom Thurmond, to leave the National Convention in Philadelphia. Mounting a third-party Dixiecrat candidacy with Thurmond at the top of the ticket, within 20 years, these Southerners would find a home in an increasingly conservative Republican Party determined to turn back the civil rights achievements of the 1960s and 1970s. That's the world we live in today. Republicans occupy the political right, referring to Democrats uniformly as the left. Ironically, many progressive Democrats disdain liberals, viewing them as the most conservative wing of their own coalition. But that's not what it means to be liberal. Instead, liberalism, as it first cohered in the New Deal, then Harry S. Truman's Fair Deal, and then Lyndon Johnson's Great Society, imagines that government's role is to take the actions, provide the support, and pass the laws that free all Americans to prosper. This is why I invited James Traub, a journalist, historian, and expert on liberalism, to talk to us today about his new book, True Believer: Hubert Humphrey's Quest for a More Just America. Traub takes us from Humphrey's roots in a small South Dakota town to his years as party whip in the Senate, and then vice president to Lyndon Johnson, and his role in masterminding passage of the landmark 1964 Civil Rights Act. And yet, if Humphrey's life's work demonstrates liberalism's achievements, it also illustrates its frustrations and flaws. Liberal foreign policies that are at odds with human rights abroad, holding together a Democratic Party that embraces so many different impulses, and above all, the constant need for compromise. To paraphrase Humphrey himself, liberalism moves freedom forward by asking for a loaf, but being willing to take crumbs. Join Jim Traub and me for this episode of Why Now, where history and politics meet the challenge of today. And I'm your host, Claire Potter, Professor of History Emeritus at the New School for Social Research, a contributing editor at Public Seminar, and the author of the Political Junkie Substack. This is episode 48, The Bright Sunshine of Human Rights. James Traub, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Claire.
So, Jim, I have to tell you, I finished reading this book about half an hour ago, and in the last chapter, I cried.
That is the goal of all of us biographers. That's what we want.
And I didn't expect to. I was one of those young people watching the convention in 1968 and hating Humphrey's guts. And you told me a whole new story about this man. And I wonder if you could tell our listeners, what is the arc of Hubert Humphrey's life?
Well, Claire, if I can just start from that ending point. For people who are not as old as we are, they might not know why Humphrey was an object of hatred in 1968. So if for a moment we start at the end, this was the man who was the vice president to Lyndon Johnson. And in 1968, when Lyndon Johnson decided not to run for president and Hubert Humphrey did run for president and did win the Democratic nomination, he was despised by almost every young person, at least politically active young people, as the co-architect of the Vietnam War. And that's what he remains in the minds of a lot of people of that age. People who are older know a different Hubert Humphrey, and people who are younger, who don't think about 1968 but are interested in politics and history, know a different Hubert Humphrey. So let me just say a few words about that person. First, Hubert has a kind of mythic background, the kind of background that actually normally does make you a president, because he's born in a tiny town in eastern South Dakota, almost exactly halfway across the country. His father is a pharmacist, but his father is also one of these Midwestern prairie idealists. He could have been scripted by Aaron Copland. And Hubert was raised to be a patriot, to be a thinker about politics, to be a Christian, a good person. He was super smart. He was ambitious. And so he wanted to go into politics to do good. That's what he assumed politics was for. And when he was very young, he lived through the Depression. So in the Midwest, the Depression came about 5 years before it did in the East. It wasn't a financial thing. It had to do with crop prices and then with crop failure. And it was devastating. And Hubert lived through that. And then he lived through FDR's moment in 1933 when he takes over and he says, in effect, I will not let farmers starve. And so Hubert saw that government could make an immense and immediate difference in people's lives. Federal money poured into South Dakota, and it was a terrible, grim time, but people didn't starve. So FDR became Hubert's beau ideal. That's what politics was for. It was to do good for people. He thought he'd be a political scientist. He went to LSU to get his master's. He wrote his master's in the political philosophy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The whole thesis is a great justification of liberalism as it was understood then. Then he returns to Minnesota, where he went to college, runs for mayor, loses the first time, wins the second time. Wildly popular mayor, beloved figure, one of these guys like Fiorello, who was a big city mayor at a time when America loved big cities. Hard to believe that was so, but it was so. Crusading figure, he broke the grip of the mob in Minneapolis. Much beloved, could have been mayor for life. Runs for Senate and wins. Before that happens comes the key moment in his career. In 1948, the Democratic Party was in the thrall of the South, as it had been since the Civil War. That's what the party was. And for that reason, it was the Democrats, not the Republicans, who were the great obstacle to the passage of even the most basic civil rights legislation. And in 1948, not only Hubert, but the whole party elite was convinced that Harry Truman was not going to win. He was going to lose to whoever ran for the Republicans. He was terribly unpopular. Perhaps more so, in fact, than Joe Biden is today, now that I think about it. A nice thought to hold in mind. And so they said, look, we're going to lose anyway. Let's make this election a matter of principle, and the great principle is civil rights. We've got to challenge our own party. And Hubert was such a leading figure. He was then the head of something called Americans for Democratic Action, the great Cold War liberal group. They said, Hubert, you have to be the person to carry this message. And he said he would. He went to the Democratic convention. He proposed a minority plank for the party platform that would have demanded anti-lynching legislation, the creation of a civil rights commission, the desegregation of public facilities, all sorts of things that were anathema to the South. There was an immense debate, conflagration, confrontation, and miraculously and quite unexpectedly, the reformers won. It was a shocking thing. It was really the beginning of the revolt of the South against the Democratic Party, but it made Hubert a heroic figure. And so he went to the Senate, and Hubert was a senator from 1949 until he became vice president in 1965. And during that time, he was the great champion of civil rights, of labor issues, of foreign aid, of disarmament. In all those fields, he was the leading figure. He was an extraordinary figure. And so that's why older people remember Hubert as a heroic liberal and a tragic figure in 1968. But if, as you said, Claire, 1968 was the moment when people on the left thought, I don't care what he used to be, he's a monster.
Of course, in 1968, thousands of young people are in the streets being beaten by Mayor Daley's cops. And Hubert is doing what he knows how to do, which is keep politics moving. And it's exactly the wrong thing to do, although what the right thing to do at that point would have been is very hard to say. So, Jim, I want to then roll you backward again to South Dakota, this godforsaken little town on the plains where our Hubert is born. And he is born to Hubert Humphrey Sr. And you make what I think is the marvelous decision to refer to Hubert by his childhood name, which is Pinky. Can you tell us about Pinky and how you saw the future senator in this young man who was full of verve and bubble and couldn't stop talking?
So Pinky was the kind of person who, if you were a grandparent, if you were an old person in Darwin, South Dakota, you thought he was the most wonderful little boy in the world. I suppose if you were an ironical person at all, he might drive you crazy. He was a nonstop enthusiast. He played every sport, though he was a little shrimp. And he's played in the school play, and he was the head of debate, and he could not stop talking in class. Teachers would have to tell him to shut up. He would carry the old people's grocery. He would work on their car. He would hoe their garden. One thing that actually I didn't realize till I paid attention was that this guy was the hardest working person around. He said later, I didn't know what a vacation was until I was an adult. I hadn't heard the word vacation. So for all this kind of bubbliness and gregariousness, he was incredibly hardworking, and that served him very well for the rest of his life. He was a deeply idealistic person. So his father would sit the kids down and read to them from biographies of Abraham Lincoln. He would read the speeches of William Jennings Bryan. He would read the speeches of Woodrow Wilson. This is how they grew up. And, you know, I'm writing a book now about learning about civics and history education. And when I think about this, the kind of civics education Hubert Humphrey had at home, it was training to become the man he became.
And then his family, this hardworking, decent family, is absolutely ruined by the Great Depression. Something happens to Hubert, and I think this is an important turning point in the biography, where he does what he has to do. He comes home from college at the University of Minnesota. He goes to work for his father. He does his best to keep the family afloat. And it looks like he might be trapped there forever. How does he get out?
There is a 7-year period when Hubert is treading water. Nothing's happening in his life. Towards the end, he meets the woman who will become his wife, whom he's very much in love with. That keeps him afloat. But he's working in his father's drugstore because they can't afford to send him to college. He thinks, I'm going to be trapped here forever. And if you've ever spent time in a flat place in the middle of the country, there is a kind of illimitable sense that makes you feel like everything is just too far away and I'm never, ever going to get out of this endless place. That's how he felt. But there was a fire in the guy. There was a tremendous fuel in the guy. And he went to Washington in the middle of this, 1935, and he saw this great machine at work. And he writes letters home to Muriel, then his girlfriend, not yet his wife. And they're romantic. They're romantic about Washington. They're romantic about government service. He's seen the most beautiful thing of his life. He is in love with it. And he says, don't laugh at me, Muriel. Someday, I'm going to come back here. And so In that way, he's such a kind of American hero. You know, he's fired by this vision and he says, I'm going to get out of this dinky little place, which, by the way, he loved. But nevertheless, he was at that point in his life almost tormented. And so finally, he's able to return to college at the University of Minnesota. His father makes do. His older brother, Ralph, stays behind, continues working at the pharmacy. Hubert never goes back to South Dakota, never goes back to the pharmacy. And from then on in, he's launched on his life path.
So let's skip to his first great triumph, which is becoming mayor of Minneapolis and is known around the country as the boy mayor. What is it about Hubert that draws the eyes of the nation to him?
So Hubert does a few really extraordinary things that become national stories. The one that probably endeared him most to citizens, though was less of a national story, was he broke the grip of the mob. We don't, you know, Minneapolis to us is about the cleanest city in America. But in the 1930s and 40s, in part because of the proximity to Canada, meant that during Prohibition, it was a tremendous source of bootlegging, and that in turn generated other things like gambling, sports gambling. Hubert hired a G-man, a guy who'd been trained by Hoover, and they broke the mob. They really did. And so that was an extraordinary thing. That was a big deal. But the other thing that was so unusual was that Hubert said civil rights. Now, in those days, the word they used was human rights. Minneapolis was a famously anti-Semitic city. Even among other cities, it was a place where Jews couldn't join any kind of club, couldn't do anything, really had to live in their own world. Minneapolis had a pretty big Jewish population, a very small black population. And you could say, if Hubert were a calculating man, he would have tried to do something about the religious issue because he would have wanted Jewish votes. There was no political value in helping black people, none. And yet from the time, even before he was mayor, Hubert had spoken at every black church. He was known to the very few people in the black community who were political activists as their friend and as a person who would never condescend to them. He seemed to be actually devoid of the kind of condescension that had been bred into almost all white people at that time. He had just not been raised to think that way. Well, first it began with a survey. He did a survey of people's attitudes. Well, not surprisingly, they were anti-Semitic and racist. But the thing that mattered is that he convened this enormous group of people who went house to house talking to people. And the conveners were significant black sociologists from Fisk. And so it was being run by black guys. And so the exercise itself was very important. Hubert also pushed very hard for what was called a Fair Employment Practices Commission. That was the term that was used then for a body that would look into claims of racial discrimination in employment. There were a few municipal ones in cities in America, very few. Hubert's was the only one that had any enforcement power at all. Not very much, but it was the toughest one in the United States. That brought him a lot of attention. That probably has something to do with why it was that when a group of Cold War liberals were thinking about creating this new organization, the Americans for Democratic Action, one of the first people they approached to be part of it was Hubert.
And Hubert is really picking up the ball at a moment when civil rights action from government has stalled. Hubert's hero, FDR, had created an FEPC at the federal level right before World War II, but really the period after the war where the Black civil rights movement is really trying to get going, there's no impetus at all from Washington to help. And that continues for a long time. So when Humphrey gives that speech at the Democratic Convention for Civil Rights, it's a very big deal, isn't it?
You have to bear in mind something that's almost too shocking to think about, but is true, which is from 1876, when Reconstruction effectively came to an end, until that moment, nothing had happened. Not in the South, anyway. I mean, it would be wrong to say that the condition of Black people had not improved at all, at least in the North. It had. But the legal system of second-class citizenship had not changed in the least, not at the national level anyway, and certainly not in the South. And so
as far as the Democratic Party was concerned, that was livable. And indeed, there's an interesting immediate backdrop, which is Truman, who really deserves more credit than he gets as an enlightened person on these matters. And I make the analogy that just as everyone loves FDR and thinks Truman is a hack, and everyone loved Kennedy and thought Johnson was a yokel, the fact is Truman was more enlightened than FDR on these matters, just as LBJ was more enlightened than Kennedy on these matters. And so Truman convened a panel to recommend what to do about civil rights. And it came back with a series of seven bold recommendations. Truman got scared. He endorsed them, and then he walked away from them as far as possible. And so at this moment in July of 1948, when the Democratic National Convention occurs, the party has effectively said to the South, don't worry, we're going to readopt what we did in 1944, which was vague hortatory language that people should all be treated alike, but there were no promises of any kind whatsoever. That's what the activists said could not be allowed to stand.
What Humphrey does, and I think you say this pretty directly in the book, is redefine liberalism around civil rights at that moment. And not just civil rights, but a whole series of issues that had really been associated with progressives who were borderline communist. And Humphrey, of course, had played a big role in pushing communists out of the Democratic Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota. So he can't be tarred with the communist brush. And he has this opportunity to redefine liberalism. And then he goes to the Senate and begins an unholy alliance with Lyndon Johnson, which will both lift him up and toss him to the absolute depths of his political life.
It's so intriguing. It's so profound. And as you say in the end, it's so painful. Robert Caro, is the great biographer of Lyndon Johnson, is very good on the fact that Johnson had an unbelievable instinct for what men needed, for their weakness. He and Hubert came to the Senate at the same time. They were elected in 48. They didn't have much contact at first because Johnson hung out with the Southerners, and none of the Southerners would even talk to Hubert because, of course, he was the guy who had destroyed the old consensus. And Johnson saw that Hubert was dejected. I mean, his sense of isolation and exclusion was terrible at first. And Johnson befriended him. And Hubert was extremely grateful. Hubert was a grateful person anyway. And those first years were miserable in a way that had never been true in his whole life. So he felt a deep gratitude to Johnson. Now, Johnson had this gift of mastery. And so he would dominate people, and then he would give them something that would make them feel that they had gained something terribly important from the relationship. And so he was 3 years older than Hubert, not a significant amount, but he was terribly wise in the ways of politics. Hubert was not. Hubert knew how to move an audience. Johnson did not. It's intriguing to me that Johnson had no interest in learning from Hubert, whereas Hubert was an eager pupil of Johnson's. And so Hubert's political education in the Senate was in what I call the Academy of Lyndon Johnson. He learned how to get a bill through the Senate. He learned how to get little pieces of what you want. He learned how to wait. He learned how to maneuver men towards his own position. And the culmination of that education came in 1964, Hubert's perhaps greatest moment. 1948 and 1964 was two great moments. So in 64, of course, John F. Kennedy has been assassinated. Johnson's president. The Civil Rights Act is on the agenda. It is the agenda. It is the moment that people like Hubert have been waiting for since 1948. Nothing has been possible. It has been impossible to redeem the promise, the pledge that was made in 48 until that moment. Johnson handpicks Hubert to run that legislation. Hubert is the majority whip of the Senate. He's not the majority leader of the Senate. He's not the head of the committee that considered the legislation, because the head of the committee is James Eastland, a notorious racist from Mississippi. That's the Judiciary Committee where the bill came up. So it's not clear who's going to actually be responsible. Johnson says it's going to be Hugh. And for 5 months, this is almost all the Senate does. And Hubert uses everything he learned from LBJ, but so many things he didn't learn from LBJ. For example, he insists on having an extensive discussion of every element of this enormous, complicated bill. And so he faces down the Southerners. He forces them to consider the merits of the bill. And he assigns each measure of the bill to different people. And he's very good at taking people who don't usually get the light shined on them in the Senate to do so. Even moderate Republicans, even not so moderate, relatively conservative Republicans like Roman Fruska of Nebraska. And so one by one, he gets people on his side. The goal ultimately is to defeat the filibuster that the South is using. Take 67 people, and Hubert has to get them one by one by one by one by one. And finally, at the end, he sits with Johnson, and Johnson says, Hubert, you don't know how to count. You don't really have 67, do you? And Hubert says, I do have 67. I have more than 67. And in the end, he gets 71. So it was an astonishing, magnificent victory.
In all of the history books where Lyndon Johnson is credited with pushing through this legislation, we need to rewrite them and say, actually, it was Hubert Humphrey, you idiots. Now, Humphrey, at that moment, has had several feelers from the party about running for president. In 1964, Johnson is running for election for the first time because he had inherited the presidency from Kennedy, and he picks Humphrey. And Humphrey thinks, this is it. This is where I take this penultimate step to my dream of being a president, where I will do great things. And it has to be the worst decision he ever made, right?
Yes, and though it needs to be said that Hubert did not go into this entirely blind. So his friend said, Hubert, there is no job worse than being the vice president to this man. His need to dominate means the vice president is going to be crushed. And let's remember, John F. Kennedy crushed him, and he's going to do to you what Kennedy did to him. And Hubert said, yes, but the only way that a man like me, born poor, from a small state with nothing special like Dwight Eisenhower had to recommend him, is ever going to be president except by being vice president first. There's a reasonable claim to be made that Lyndon Johnson, who really was in many ways a terrible campaigner, a brilliant retail politician, also would never have been president had he not become vice president first. And not to be too morbid about it, Johnson had had a terrible heart attack. Everyone in his family, all the men in his family, died young. He said to Hubert, and this was a secret that Hubert never divulged. He said to Hubert in September of 64, after he had already nominated him, he said, Hubert, I'm not going to run for a second term because I won't live that long. So there was some part of Hubert, he may have buried the thought, but there was some part of Hubert that thought, I'll make it for 4 years. And then I'll have my chance.
Johnson does everything he possibly can to take that chance away. He blocks Humphrey at every turn. Every time Humphrey says something, Johnson says, no, that's wrong. You did it wrong. And so Humphrey is faced with this relentless bullying as the vice president. And it's almost as if Johnson saw things in Hubert that he didn't have and was determined to kill him off. And yet he doesn't succeed. And in the end, Johnson, in the final days, says, you know, all right, I'll get behind Hubert. But it's too late,
so,
isn't it?
It's too late, yeah. So the sadism is really astonishing. It's just, it is so painful to listen to the telephone recordings of Johnson and Humphrey. Because if you listen to other recordings of Johnson and McGeorge Bundy or Robert McNamara, they speak as man to man. When Johnson speaks to Humphrey, he is speaking almost man to boy. He is diminishing him in the conversation. He's cutting him off. He's undermining him. He's ridiculing him. And Hubert, after a while, is like a beaten dog. You know, he's got the flinch mechanism built into himself. And so that's part of the painfulness, too, that Schubert is desperately propitiating this angry god. And so it's 4 years of this, which, by the way, I want to say Schubert, when he looks back on it, does not say, as any normal human would say, that was a Calvary. That was terrible. No, not at all. What an opportunity I had. And when Walter Mondale is asked by Jimmy Carter in 1976 to be his running mate, Walter Mondale is also from Minnesota, Hubert's his great friend and mentor. They sit in the Senate dining room and Walter says, Schubert, should I do it? And Schubert says, why do you even ask that question? Of course you should do it. It's the greatest opportunity a person can ever have. That's Schubert.
I'm just thinking about Schubert as a man who in many ways believed his whole life was luck and opportunity and joy right around the corner. It's something about the man's personality that, anyway, you go on, Jim.
No, but I mean, this is true. This is it's what made him seem so naive in the late 1960s. Anybody who talks and thinks like that is not in contact with reality. That's how we all thought then. But that was Schubert. I mean, that's Schubert. He came out of the womb like that. And so whenever I asked the people who knew him about whether this or that made him bitter, they would say, bitter? Schubert wasn't bitter. Schubert didn't know the word bitterness. He was devoid of bitterness. He was not resentful when he should have been resentful. He knew what Johnson did to him. But when he talked about Johnson, when, for example, after Johnson's death at the memorial service or in the Senate, in the immediate aftermath of Johnson's death, Schubert gave the most stirring and selfless speeches about Johnson. Not a word of recrimination crept in. So March 31st of 1968, Johnson, who really is tortured by the war in Vietnam, announces to the American public in a big speech, I'm not going to run. Schubert had no idea. He had absolutely no idea. He wanted Johnson to run. He wasn't ready to run, but he ran. And he ran at the worst moment a person could have. 4 days later, April 4th, Martin Luther King is assassinated. 2 months after that, Bobby Kennedy is assassinated. Who wants to be in politics then? Who wants to be trying to inspire people then? The mood of the country was so sour and angry, and the anti-war demonstrations were getting worse. Urban violence was getting worse. The reaction on the right was getting worse. The so-called hard hat riot in New York, when construction workers beat up protesters, the ugliness of the country. For all that we think that our own moment is so uniquely polarized, and I would say in certain ways it is, but the atmosphere of violence just precipitating out of the air at that moment was so great that it was the worst possible environment, especially for a man like Schubert, who was so full of joy.
You know, it's really the moment in which the project that Humphrey has devoted his adult life to, which is liberalism and liberal policymaking, is failing. And Humphrey is still wedded to certain kinds of approaches like full employment in the cities, that will do something about the violence, to really sort of keeping all the balls in the air around Vietnam, because we can't allow the North Vietnamese to just zoom in and take over. It's really not his fault. It's this moment that he is both expected to be a leader in, but there's nothing left to lead in the Democratic Party on a certain level.
Schubert, I think I use the expression, is crushed by the millstones of the left and the right. And so, again, thinking about our own moment, this intense polarization, at that time, because of the war, young men going off to die, the violence in the cities and elsewhere, the sense of polarization was connected to something incredibly angry, fervid, urgent, frightful. And so Schubert lost the left. The right viewed the Democrats as being the cause of chaos. That was everyone's favorite word there, chaos. The chaos on campus, the chaos of the demonstrators, the chaos in the cities. And so many traditional Democrats, working class Democrats, at first defected to George Wallace. So George Wallace, who'd come along in 64, now was a potent force. And the beginnings of the world we live in today, of a white working class outraged by what we would call cultural issues, values issues. That's the moment when this really begins in 68. There are moments at the low points of the campaign in 68 when Hubert's poll numbers are hardly above Wallace's. He's about 7 points above Wallace. Richard Nixon, the Republican candidate, was not yet then the evil monster that he came to be seen as after he became president and after Vietnam. He was just a conservative Republican. Older people remembered that he was a shameless red baiter, but he basically ran a very moderate campaign. He wouldn't say a word about Vietnam. He hardly said a word about anything because he knew if he just sat tight, he'd win. And so Hubert lost his own right wing, first to Wallace, but many of those people ultimately went to Nixon. The left despised him, though ultimately many of those people voted for him. Something else, by the way, we should keep in mind thinking about today, when we read about all these voters who will say, I will never vote for Joe Biden because of Gaza, because of whatever it is. Well, most people like that when they have to choose between not voting at all and voting for someone who has disappointed them very bitterly, will still vote for that person. So in that regard, Hubert's example may tell us that Biden's situation is not quite as dire as we think with his own left wing.
That is very good to hear, Jim. And I hope our listeners are really paying attention to that. So what happens to Hubert after 68? He's crushed. Then he goes back to the Senate. Then there's this sort of brief flurry of him running for president again in 72. He dyes his hair. He gets some trendy clothes, but it doesn't work out. And he dies at an extraordinarily young age. Why should our listeners read a book about Hubert Humphrey at this moment?
So I'll give you a couple reasons, Claire. The one that's most directly relevant that really interests me is actually the last phase. So in his last phase, when he runs again for Senate in Minnesota, and he spends the last 7 years of his life as a senator, he's confronting the dead end that his party, that he and his party got into, which is that white working class voters, the core of the old FDR coalition, think the Democratic Party is saying to them, politics is about you guys who have sacrificing so that those who have been historically mistreated, black people, can be made whole. And they're saying, in effect, if that's what it is, I'm a Republican. And so Hubert tried to think his way out of that box. And this is a situation, it's not exactly analogous, but it's actually quite closely analogous to the one that Joe Biden is in. And similarly to Biden, Hubert tried to find his way to a politics that had much more to do with class than with race. And in Hubert's case, that meant actually angering people. He was not a fan of affirmative action. He was not a fan of school desegregation. He was not a fan of what they called in those days set-asides, setting aside seats in the Democratic National Convention for women, youth, black people. And he said to his audiences, we have to find policies and language that speak to the hopes and the fears of middle-class white people as well as black people. We have to find where that place is. And so for Hubert, first of all, it meant he became quite tough on law and order, the great issue of the day. Again, piercingly relevant to the Democrats' current situation. But his affirmative message was, and this is a word you used yourself earlier, full employment. He didn't speak the language anymore of fair employment, meaning ending discrimination. He said, no, we have to find decent, dignified jobs for everyone. Now, that led Hubert to actually a very left-wing place, left-wing for that time and left-wing for our time. So he championed a bill called Humphrey-Hawkins, which ultimately passed, which initially said the government would guarantee not only jobs, but good jobs to everyone. If you couldn't find a job in the private market, the government would step in. And everyone said, Hubert, that's nuts. That's so inflationary. Even the union said, you're crazy. And Hubert recognized that. But there was a part of him that said, okay, let's pay that price. And he said, you're so worried about inflation and all this. He said, take a walk with me through our cities. And I'll show you, he says, in this era of, these are wonderfully quaint terms, hot lather, shaving machines, and electric can openers. That's like high tech. We have people who've never been to a good school and have never been to a decent doctor's office. What are we going to do about that? And that moral passion, that kept pushing the Democratic Party. Hubert didn't even matter anymore. He had no seniority. And yet he came back to being a tremendously powerful figure in the party because he was its conscience. And so we're kind of in this place now. And we have seen that, unfortunately, politically, inflation is a much more potent issue than unemployment. And so Hubert may just have been wrong on that one. And yet this wish to find a way out of what we now call neoliberalism to an economy that offers security and dignity to ordinary people, that's very much the center of the struggle of the current Democratic Party.
And that's it for today's show. Thanks for listening. You can subscribe to Why Now on your favorite podcast platform. Please leave a rating and a comment so that other listeners can find us. Go to the Political Junkie Substack at clairepotter.substack.com for show notes, to listen to more episodes, or leave a comment. You can subscribe for free, or you can support my work for as little as $5 a month and get every podcast and every newsletter delivered straight to your desktop. Share this podcast with a friend who loves history, politics, and smart conversation. And you can follow me on Threads, Blue Sky, or Instagram. Why Now is supported by the New School for Social Research and by paying subscribers to Political Junkie. Why Now and Political Junkie are written, recorded, edited, and produced by me, Claire Potter. My opening theme is by Galaxy News, and my closing theme is by Avocado Junkie. That's all for now. See you next time.